Vessel the Podcast is sponsored by Dan Leaf Moonshine in Leaf.
I'm afraid to tell you that this episode needs to open with a fess, Rob.
OK, I'll try my best. I've never recovered from hearing my mum say to my dad, "Lick my fart hole," when getting up for a wee in the middle of the night.
Comments include, "Isn't that from the letters of James Joyce?"
Thank you, red-trousered misanthropist, for that.
Have you ever heard your parents do the dirty talk, Rob?
I've never heard my parents do the dirty talk, but I did once walk in on my dad biting my mother's neck on the sofa, and they see me, and my mum goes, "I had an itch!"
Oh, my God.
I mean, that's maybe how it started.
Yes. I've been listening to a podcast about James Bond, and one of the things they've remarked on is that Pierce Brosnan always bites women's necks when he's having sex with them as James Bond.
Oh, God. Like a vampire.
His sex move.
Don't invite James Bond into your house, because everyone's going to get shot and bitten probably as well.
They'll be shaken but not stirred.
Welcome to the Fesshole Podcast, where Rob Manuel and David Stevenson take this week's most terrible confessions and cringe at the horror of it all. I'm Rob Manuel, and I've been running this Fesshole account for 5 years.
And I'm David Stevenson, and I get dragged into Rob's projects, regardless of whether I want to or not. And our producer tells us we need to encourage listeners to subscribe, rate and review wherever they get their podcasts.
And this week we've got a special guest, clergyman and author Fergus Butler Galley.
Hello, lovely to be here.
Thank you. I'll just go straight in actually with this. Touching Cloth, I've been listening to it this afternoon, the audiobook version. You went straight in with like a poo gag for the title. Is that right?
Yeah. I didn't want anyone to get me under the Trading Standards Act and think it was something very serious and kind of contemplative. I mean, it's got serious bits in it, right? But
yeah.
I wanted to make clear from the get-go that this was not a kind of book for serious churchy types, that it was always designed to have a bit of humour in it. It wasn't designed to be taken completely seriously.
Have you got a support, like in, you know, 'cause you get bookshops in like churches, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I will go occasionally. I'll get asked to go and preach at another church, and someone will always sort of come up and be like, "Oh, I don't know whether I'm allowed to do this." And they will kind of bring up the book, and they'll often say, "Oh, I bought it here, or we bought it in church, or someone told us about it." So yeah, they are supportive broadly.
That's an amazing commercial model, isn't it? If you can sort of sell the products in this. I mean, how many churches are in the UK?
Oh, thousands.
Every one. Opportunity to sell.
Well, I also calculated that every vicarage is legally has to have a downstairs loo. There's a fact for you. Every single vicarage. And obviously you need to put books in your downstairs loo that aren't very serious. So I thought, well, if I can calculate how many vicarages there are, I can sell at least that number.
Is that a true thing? They're legally required to have a downstairs loo?
Yeah, you've got to have a loo that is separate from your... Because the weird thing about a vicarage is it's both your place of work and a place where you live, right?
Yeah.
So you've got to have a loo that is accessible to punters off the street, people who might come and meet you in your office, that isn't part of your private home.
So is this a handy wee tip that any vicarage, you can knock on the door and go...
Knock on the door. You've got a loo. I know you've got it in there. Don't hide it.
What about just houses that are called a vicarage? Is it still like...
Yeah, if it's the old vicarage, there'll be a little bit more kind of just like, we sold our loo rights to this in the 1970s.
Stand up for your loo rights.
What we're going to do at the top is we're going to throw a bunch of questions at you. And then halfway through, we're going to throw a bunch of confessions at you to react to. And then we're going to finish off with a bunch of questions submitted by people who submit questions to Fesshole. Does that sound like something you can get through?
Absolutely. Three parts. I can do that.
Three sections. So the top bit is questions. And so me and Dave are going to take it turns doing these questions. And this one, okay, this one, I know this is the annoying question because I have genuinely read the first bit of your book at least, and your book opens with like, oh my God, everyone just says, why did you want to become a priest? And then you go through and explain where the thing is stressed in the different words and the different meanings, but we still need to ask it.
Well, I want you to ask it so I can hear where you're going to stress the question.
Well, that's really hard now because like I've got it in front of me. So why did you want to become a priest?
Is it?
I'm going to do double stress.
Multiple stresses, which is what being a priest is often like, multiple stresses.
Very good.
Well, I always tell people it's because I was told black was slimming, and that is what I wear most of the time, in fact, what I'm wearing now. But yeah, there are lots of different answers to that question. There's sort of one answer I give is that you get to a point where you can't not, if that makes sense. It's like an itch. You know, in the middle of the night, you get an itch and you've got a question in your head. Do I disturb myself and itch my foot now? Or do I wait for 40 minutes and then pretend that it's not there and then have to itch it anyway? There's a bit of an element of that, that you feel this sense that this is something you ought to at least explore. And I guess what you're always hoping is at some point people are going to say, you know what, that's a really stupid idea. Go away. What were you thinking? Off your piss. What were you thinking? And I'm still sort of waiting for that to happen, really. I think a lot of priests, it's about, they call it testing your vocation, almost pushing against the kind of idea of this and working out whether it's actually viable. So yeah, you feel you have to scratch the itch. That's what a very wise priest said to me. Go and scratch the itch. But it's something that just, you know, I wasn't brought up in a religious family at all. I wasn't from a religious background. My parents didn't really have anything to do with religion. They, you know, I don't know, we went to church at Christmas sometimes, but that was about it. So it's something that I kind of came across as a teenager and a bit older. And I sort of thought, okay, well, let's keep on exploring. Let's keep on pushing. Let's take this to its logical conclusion. And here I am.
Was there sort of like any kind of like rival things you were like thinking, oh, I could be a tractor driver, stand-up comedian?
As a kid, I really wanted to be a bin man. I was a very weird kid. I loved the smell of bins. I absolutely loved bins. I remember my grandparents, they lived in a town and I lived in the countryside, and they had a wheelie bin. And I thought this was the best thing ever.
And you could be a bin man and huff bin juice all day.
Oh, yeah. I would have rolled around in bin juice. I was a horrible goblin child rolling around in bin juice. I loved it. I love bins. And I particularly like the idea, the mechanism of something that picked up a bin and then tipped it into the back and crunched it all up.
Yeah,
those are cool lorries.
They are cool lorries. And when I was a little boy, what I wanted to be was a bin man, more than anything else in the whole world. Yeah, there were other things. My family, my dad, and all the way back to, like, I don't know, the Battle of Waterloo, they were all in the army. And I remember telling my dad, said, actually, I'm not going to be in the army. I think I'm going to join the church. And I thought he was going to be disappointed. And he kind of sat back and he went, well, you know what? They're not that difficult, because in both of them, the outfit's stupid and the pay's crap. So that was his kind of reaction to it.
And there's like a hierarchy kind of structural kind of thing going on.
Yeah, whenever he asks me a question about my job, I have to explain it to him in army terms. Like, well, that's a bit like...
The bishops are like, they can send them all into battle.
Yeah.
It would be a Monty Python sketch, wouldn't it? Be sending off a load of...
Yeah, a load of vicars.
They can only move diagonally, the bishops.
Yeah,
they...
And then you'd have the SAS having to be parochial clergy doing kind of tea mornings and coffee mornings with the WI.
You sort of preempted my next question, so I'm going to jump one ahead. I was just wondering, like, how much of your time is taken up with providing a listening ear in between all the other sort of duties of a priest?
Yeah, it's one of those things that sort of is sprung on you, right? You've always kind of got to be ready to do that. So actually, I sort of had it this morning where I was in church, I was doing some stuff, and someone came in. And in the end, they didn't really want to talk about anything. It wasn't that they came in and unburdened themselves. It was just they wanted to chat. But I hadn't factored that into my day. So you've always got to be ready to kind of drop stuff. And yeah, and listen, because by, you know, wearing your collar, that's basically what you're saying. You're saying, I'm available. I'm here to listen. You can tell me stuff. So yeah, it does. It happens a fair bit.
It's sort of like the lit up thing on a taxi.
In Touching Cloth, maybe surprisingly, the word confession only appears once. Have you got any confessions that you would like to say personally?
Oh, endlessly. I mean, it's interesting because I say a form of confession twice a day, morning and evening. When I say morning and evening prayer, you go through and I say I've done things that are wrong. I don't then list them necessarily out loud, but I will in my head. I'll think, well, you know what? You could have been nicer to that person, or you know what? You could have been given more time to that. You could have not said that, not thought that. Do I have any confessions to make now? Yeah, my confession is I'm sitting in front of this big wall of booze, which some of your listeners probably won't be able to see unless they're kind of clairvoyant or something.
Yeah, there's going to be an audio podcast, so yeah.
Yeah, so they won't be able to see it. Well, there we go. That is my confession to you now, that I am currently sitting in front of, lots of litres of alcohol because I had to move them from elsewhere. Where books normally are, there's now gin. That is a confession I have to make.
Scratch cards?
Yeah, I love scratch cards. Again, as I said, I was quite an odd child, and I loved, as a kid, there was nothing out of my mind. My grandmother would take me and just encourage me to gamble. And that was her little gift to me. But when I was in Liverpool, I still liked doing them. But when you're wearing a dog collar, you can't really go in and get the winnings. Can't really go and say, oh, I've got a tenner on my scratchy. We had a lot of members of the homeless community who we'd work with, and my gift to them would always be a scratch card. I'd say, go on.
Oh.
So I got the fun of scraping it off, which was the real joy, and the thrill of winning, and then they got to take the winnings.
There'd be a limit, wouldn't there, on this? You're not going to give them, like, your 10 grand return.
Well, when that happens, I will have to think about it, which will always be the next one I buy, obviously, because that's how it works.
So how many scratch cards are you buying a week?
At the moment, none. At the moment, none.
I've bought exactly one lottery ticket in my life, and it was a sort of like DIY rubbish art stunt where I bought the ticket and then I set fire to it before it was claimed because I was trying to do my own little version of like the KLF burning £1 million and I burnt the potential of £1 million. Yeah, it could have won, but it didn't win.
Did you win?
No, of course not. No, no. But, you know, imagine the pain in my life if that had turned out to be an actual win, you know. Throw in a question, Dave.
I can throw in a question. I was going to say that with Fessel, the fessing is anonymous, but in your line of work, there's more likely to be eye contact involved. And how do you think that changes the sort of dynamic of how people confess?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, if you go to places where they're big on confession, if you go to St. Peter's, for example, the Vatican, literally to the Vatican, they've got all these booths along the side, and they're the confession booths where you kneel or you sit on one side, and then there's a screen, so you really can't see the priest. So that possibly changes it. But what I love about those is, we're talking about taxis, they all have these little lights on the top of them to indicate whether they are occupied or not. And they have, like, you know, taxi says taxi or your bus says where it's going. They have the language that the priest can confess, do your confession in on those. Because obviously they get people from all over the world. So they're fun. So they will say English or Deutsch or Francaise or Espanol, Italiano. And then you kind of get along the line and there's kind of Hungarian ones and kind of more niche languages. But certainly when I've heard confessions, it's been face-to-face. So it's, I think it probably does change the dynamic. Interestingly, I have almost always heard confessions in parishes that weren't my own. You get asked to go and be, particularly during, you know, the lead up to Easter or times of year when people might want to make their confession, because people don't necessarily want to confess to their vicar. They want the more anonymous. So I am, to all intents and purposes, an anonymous face when that happens.
Yeah, because obviously then they don't have to see you in the shops afterwards. After this.
Buy my scratch cards.
Yeah. I like the idea of going to the confessions in Rome and then just choosing a language because you like the aesthetic of it. I just want a priest to speak to me in Italian. It's just...
Yeah, the sin would sound better in Spanish.
And confessing to someone who didn't understand me, that would have a certain sort of, well...
That'd be helpful, yeah.
Helpful, yeah. Could say some really terrible things then.
Yeah.
But I just like the image of this industrial process of confessing in the, you know, that...
It is, sort of is there, and it's funny, I think it... I guess to some people, that's a positive, right? Because, you're, as you said, there's an anonymity. You're just, you're offloading, you're doing it. You said, right, I've done that, I'm gone. I think in the Church of England, in the tradition I'm in, it's a bit more, I remember a priest telling me when I started hearing confessions, he said, part of your job is to make them realise that someone's on their side, that they're not alone, that they know what they've done is wrong, but the very fact of confessing, it means they've got someone who can support them. And so... if you think of confession like that, it's a bit more important, that it is a bit more personal than sort of like an abattoir, a supply chain kind of on the conveyor belt.
Oh my God. So you get the Catholic confession where you sort of disappear into the booth, but your tradition is just more of a face-to-face thing where it's just having a bit of a chat.
Yeah. I have done it behind a screen, but it wouldn't have taken, you know, Sherlock Holmes to work out who I was, kind of. It's pretty obvious. You can just look over the screen. So yeah, there is a difference there.
Yeah, I wonder if, like, because the stuff I'm doing, by doing, like, this just this anonymous form thing, I did it in a certain way that it is genuinely anonymous, you know, and so I have no privileged information, and that was very on purpose. And, like, there could be situations where if surely a person in a position who was receiving confessions was hearing about what's happening across all the village, there'd be temptations and problems.
Yeah, which is why the seal of the confessional is absolute. The idea is you don't then tell people what you've heard, because there has to be that trust. You know, let's say it's a village in rural Europe in the 17th century, right? You haven't got phones or ways of communication. You're going to confession then. You've got to trust that if you're going to say something that's happened, it isn't then going to be everyone down the village tavern or the shops or whatever.
You won't guess what I've heard,
oh,
mate.
You'll never guess what I've heard. Yeah, exactly. You can't have your vicar going in and doing that. So there's, well, it's trust. It's got to be built on trust. And I guess anonymity breeds trust in one level, but the other model of trust is familiarity. You trust an absolute stranger and you trust someone you're very close to. It's that middle ground that's a bit tricky, right?
I mean, you've got that kind of thing with like doctors as well, a little bit. If they're in a small community, they know too much. And so they're like, I'm not going to that cafe because I know they don't wash their hands there. But then they can be a little bit more aloof potentially, whereas you've got a kind of quite a heart of the community role as well. So that's quite a tricky dynamic, I imagine.
No, it is. Although generally we don't have to see the kind of, my mum is a doctor and, you know, the advantage of my job is they don't have to see the sort of physical effects of what people might have done wrong.
Yes. Yes.
Give us the expert's view on why we feel compelled to confess, even if we're not particularly religious types. It seems hardwired in us. What would be your answer?
It is. I think it's about unburdening, isn't it? It's about that whole, you know, problem shared is a problem halved, whatever. It is about unburdening. It's about giving voice to something, naming something, almost liberates its power over you. There's almost like a kind of magic aspect to it. By saying it, you sort of rob it of its power, because we all know that feeling, don't we, of that thing that like gnaws away in your brain or in your stomach, particularly, you know, late at night. Could be something from years ago. You know, I remember I set off a fire alarm at school and I still will get like a pang of guilt now, 25 years later.
You maliciously set off a fire alarm?
Yeah.
Just banged it?
Well, I think there was something I didn't want to do.
Don't smash glass bit?
Yeah. I was like, oh, I don't fancy that. Which did work, in fairness.
Oh, so to get out of a lesson?
Yeah, I can't remember what it was. It was some exercise I didn't want
to
do.
Well, you weren't there, so you didn't learn anything.
Yeah, no,
you
didn't learn that one thing.
Yeah. But you get stuff at school or something you should have said to someone or something you shouldn't have said to someone. I think we all get that. And we know that it can gnaw away at us, right? And I think one of the ways of breaking the power of that guilt, because that's what it is, essentially, it's about the absolution of guilt. That is what confession is about.
Right.
But you can only have that guilt absolved, can only have that power taken away by naming it, by admitting to it. So if you don't admit to it, it's still gnawing away at you, right? It's not a very complicated dynamic, really, but it's hugely powerful. And it's kind of like anything else. It's sort of requiring of being honest with ourselves, being honest with another human being, and I guess within my dynamic, honest to God as well, right?
It sounds like the kind of thing that drives people into being stand-up comedians as well.
It's oversharing, right? It's sort of, you know, I can get that out there.
You're saving us from hundreds of stand-up comedians, potentially.
I only did one good thing. There we go.
Yeah, how many roles are there? Because like, there's obviously, there's talking to a therapist, there's confessing in church. I wonder how many other things like this that are knocking around, that are this fundamental model.
Yeah, well, you bump into people. It's funny, I was speaking to a pub landlord the other day, and he said very often he would hear people, you know, end of the night, people would feel, partly because booze makes you more...
loose-tongued, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, loose-tongued. Drunk man's words are a sober man's thoughts, that kind of thing. I think also, yeah, there's kind of a vulnerability, isn't there? You're all vulnerable when you're pissed. That's a basic fact. Doctors as well, as we've said. Friends, people's friends, right? That ought to be how that works. I think friends and family. Yeah, so it can exist in a number of different kind of ways.
BT adverts...
Yeah, yeah.
I was just being silly. But I mean, it's good to talk and all that shit.
I thought you meant if you see Sid, tell him.
That was gas. That was gas, David.
Damn.
That was selling off British Gas by Thatcher.
You're not going to tell her, are you?
She knows.
Every night I pray
she
to
knows.
Thatcher.
Every night I tell Margaret Thatcher what I did wrong and she punished me.
I had impure thoughts about Starmer.
No, Rob, naughty boy.
I did actually used to confess my things in prayer when I was a lot younger, but I only knew the Lord's Prayer. So it was basically in between the daily bread. I'd be like, and because of stress, so I'd be like, and also, by the way, I was quite mean to someone at school.
But it gave you a structure to do it.
Yeah, yeah, but it was a bit weird, like just cramming it in that one bit. And trespass against us. Amen.
Yeah.
I did like the prayers I did as a kid were like just terrified about the world ending. And so I had this period age about 13, 14, where it was a combined prayer about like, tonight, please let there not be a nuclear war that would obliterate everyone. And also I got a bit sort of like fixated on the idea that AIDS was going to kill everyone as well. And so I'd have like a bit of an anti-AIDS prayer. And then that got a bit mutated into my head that maybe I could then be blessed with the anti-AIDS kind of disease that I could then spread around the world. But then I thought, oh my God, I'll be then condemned. I'd have to morally have too much sex to spread it around. Please get me awake at night. Ridiculous thoughts.
On your kind of sex tour. Sex tour of the post-nuclear wasteland.
Yes, in some very cool leather boots.
Sent by Margaret Thatcher.
There's a Netflix show in that. I could do a grinding change in tone right now, which is...
Go on, do your grinding change in tone.
Obviously, some confessions more interesting than others. Do you have any kind of things you will say to kind of get you through them or what to kind of tell?
Well, it's funny. There was a bishop, an American bishop, famously said that he used to hear a lot of confessions of nuns, little old ladies and nuns. And like most of them had just lived these very simple lives. And he said, hearing those confessions was like being stoned to death by popcorn. Because he said they were chucking these light little things at you, but just the sheer volume, the little things that a sweet old lady can find in her head as being, oh, I shouldn't have done that. And he said it was particularly oppressive because when you've got someone coming to you, and I found this, and I remember priests telling me this, someone will come to you and say, I've done this awful, wicked thing, and it's on my heart, and I can't wait to get rid of it. And it's something you've done before you've had your morning pee, right? It's something that's just completely like par for the course in your own existence. That kind of does hit you. You're like, oh, maybe I am a really horrible person. Oh, so God. There's an element of that, that there's a burden in hearing it. Part of the time is reminding people that certain things are not actually sins or don't need confessing, that it isn't the case that God is angry at you for doing something like that. But very often it's about giving them the space and the dynamic to free themselves of the thing that is kind of worrying them. Even if it's something that seems to you is stupid, you kind of have to look as interested as if they were confessing a spate of horrific murders.
Maybe not quite that interested, but you're like...
No.
Like, Netflix series.
Looking for ways out, no.
Okay, this is a producer question. Your book details your frustrations working in the Church of England and its attitudes to such things as gay marriage. At one point, you joke that the church will be tying itself in knots about sex until the second coming.
Well, it's just endless, isn't it? It's just whenever you hear see the headline that has Church of England in it, it will be about sex, which sort of isn't what I went into it for. I didn't want to be a kind of sex therapist or a kind of sex inspector. Sounds like one of those kind of Robin Asquith films, Confessions of a Sex Inspector. Yeah, I didn't come into it to do that. And so it's just endlessly frustrating that most people, will, when they see Church of England, they think, oh, those are the people who just endlessly bang on about sex. It's just a bit wearing.
Shall I do some of my stupid questions then, which was like, can you solve... Because like, I do like a little fesshole comedy show and I'll dress as like I got a £15 kind of, I think it's a vicar thing. It's got like a white collar and a black robe.
It's very offensive, Rob.
A full smock. And then I've got like a red, I think it's a bishop's hat. But then I think it's the whole thing, Catholic confessions. I'm lost.
Well, you're doing what's known there as mixed bathing. You're mixing your outfits. You're kind of wearing different bits, a bit of a mismatch. Talking of online stuff, there is a Facebook group made up exclusively of very angry vicars. Every time someone who's supposed to be a vicar comes on TV or is in a play or is in a film, and it is them saying how they've got the clothes wrong. That is it. It's them moaning, like absolutely kicking off about how would anyone know that a maniple doesn't go over your neck or things like that. So I'm going to report you to that.
That's okay.
And I'm going to have them make your life a misery. That's my plan.
So what would they do? They just mock me. Would they get in touch or anything?
They would suggest kind of knowing what a mozzetta is, which I don't even technically know. I think it's like a little mini cape, should be like on the primary school curriculum. They think this stuff should be absolutely like drilled into everyone from day one. They would then mock you And then they would lament their kind of ignorance, and that would make them feel better. Kind of like confession, right? You would have done your job.
Okay, okay.
But by bitching about it, they would have felt better.
Is this group public access, or is it just you?
I think you have to apply to join. I think you possibly have to answer three incredibly niche questions. It's called clerical dress.
Okay.
And some of the things on it are absolutely, yeah, they're very funny. They will get their knickers quite literally in a twist.
Not knickers, though. Specific name for knickers.
No, specific clerical outfits. Yes, you're right. I remember there was like a scene in The Crown that they went absolutely mental over. It was like, it was some big scene in The Crown. It was like Princess Diana's funeral or something. And there was a priest like in the blurred background and he was wearing the wrong outfit. And these people went absolutely mad. So yeah, I would report you to them. That's what I'd do.
Okay, that's cool. If they could like protest outside one of the gigs, it could be good publicity.
Good publicity, would, yeah.
We're going to take you away from this fantastic conversation with Fergus because it's time for an ad break. Last week, we auctioned off this ad space on eBay and it's been bought by the comedian Dan Leaf to promote his Edinburgh show, Moonshine in Leaf. That's spelt L-E-I-T-H. Apologies, Dan. I have trouble with THs at the ends of words. Dan Leaf, Moonshine in Leaf, is part of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival from August the 14th to the 25th at 6:15pm in the Brewdog Doghouse Hotel upstairs bar. Dan is a Belfast-based musical comedian and the funniest man on earth with a ukulele. Now there's a sentence you've never heard before. So Google Dan Leaf, Moonshine in Leaf now and buy some tickets, okay? We hope you enjoyed that, so now back to Fergus. Do you want to react to some confessions?
Hit me with your rhythm stick and confession stick.
Okay, some of them are going to be a bit stupid.
Okay.
You're familiar with the Festhole account.
Well, I thought you'd say you're familiar with stupid people. I was like, yes, I am very familiar. I am one. Very familiar. It's great. And it is. There is a kind of group of priests who kind of will send me stuff and be like, oh, this is interesting, isn't it? That people want to get this off their chest.
Yeah, if I could get into that little group and have the priest chat, that'd be quite fun. Okay, some of these are silly, and so we could just do them. Anyway, my daughter has special needs. I took her to church at Easter. The vicar loudly proclaimed, "Hallelujah." My daughter immediately shouted, "It's raining men," brought the house down.
That, yeah, fantastic. Not done anything wrong there. Added to the gaiety of nations. Good.
So they're completely forgiven. Okay, see what you've... feel about this one. Okay. I've been a vicar in a small English village for 16 years. I love the village fates, chatting to people in the community and giving out advice when I'm asked. There's one problem. I don't believe in God.
I sort of think I can understand if that confession had come in like 1900 or 1800, when you were just, you're a character in a Jane Austen novel, right? And you got a nice big house and you were paid pretty well. I just don't know why anyone on God's green earth in this day and age would bother going through the kind of aspects that the Church of England puts you through. I mean, there's, you don't get a massive house anymore. You don't get paid very well. You don't get kudos. People are more likely to, you know, shout pedo at you in the street than say, good morning, vicar. Kind of the social cachet is gone, right? That you're not going to marry the daughter of a duke. That's gone. So my heart is almost warm that there are still people out there who are living in that world. That person, I hope they do find some kind of sense of meaning in their job, because I think my serious theological answer is, well, I think you can find God in all of that stuff. We do. Why do you do that stuff if you're not seeking God in other people?
Okay, that's sort of interesting. The idea that going through the motions has found God in a way, even though he doesn't recognise it.
I remember speaking to a priest. He gave this amazing sermon about how do you do the funeral of a kid, right? Like the worst thing that you can do as a priest. Yeah, a kid who's died. And he said, you'll have to stand up there and you'll have to say things about hope and about love and about resurrection that in that moment you don't necessarily believe because the pain is so great. Yeah. But he said, what you've got to do is fake it till you make it, because by even saying those things, it's kind of what we're saying about liberating people from pain and from sin by confessing it. Actually, in the midst of darkness, by saying you believe in the light, that in itself is an act that is kind of transgressive of the darkness that wills that into being. And God's going to be there regardless. You know, God is God. It's sort of not his problem, right? But I think for the individual and the priest or the Christian who's going through that trouble, actually part of it is that motion, that rhythm will keep you in in the kind of cradle of stuff. And then one day you'll wake up and think, oh, actually, you know what? I can see the light again.
You sort of have to embody that hope.
Right, you do, yeah.
Yeah, and I can relate to that. I can relate to that in sort of more personal relationships, you know, might have been with someone and not felt it in a moment, but kind of gone through.
Are you completely lovey-dovey in love every moment of every day? No, you have ups and downs. And it's like anything else. It's do you jack it all in for the sake of a shitty evening, or do you try and work at it, right?
I've got a downer on the next one. I don't like this one. I'm a vicar in the C of E, and I use ChatGTP to write my sermons. According to multiple parishioners, I'm preaching brilliantly every week. I'd feel guilty, but the stipend is piss poor, and this frees up many hours per week to do proper pastoral parish work. Fuck it. Actually, now I've read it through, I'm kind of pro it. But I was just down the beginning. I was thinking, like, bloody hell, that's the fun bit, getting to do a bit of a speech and a bit of a chat, you know?
Yeah. What's my reaction to that? I mean, I don't know. There are some bad sermons out there, right? I'm not surprised. We all preach a dud, right? We all have one where we think, oh, that was crap. What were you? But I did know one priest who was preaching his sermon and he just went, I'm sorry, this is a load of old rubbish. I'm just going to give you your time back. I'm just going to sit down now, pray. We'll have 2 minutes silence, then we'll get on with the rest of the service. And there's an honesty in that. I'd be surprised if every week in, week out, ChatGPT is going to do a better job, but I don't know.
Yeah, it might do a better job than someone who was crap.
Yeah.
I like the idea of starting the sermon and then just throwing away your cards, going, no, you deserve better, and then pretending you're improvising it.
Yeah, like, yeah, there's a bit of a drama queen aspect to that, I think. Yeah.
So, Dave, read the next one.
Oh, right then, if you insist. I'm a secret Christian. My husband is an atheist, as was I when we got married. But now I'm a believer, and I don't know how to tell him. Online services in lockdown have been brilliant for me, but I can't keep up the pretense forever, and I don't want to.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It happens in kind of my generation, I guess, and certainly in terms of my friendship group. Yeah, it would be more unusual to be a Christian than to not be one, right? I think there's probably, you know, you imagine, oh, I'm going to have to come out as an atheist. I think these days it's much more likely the other way around, right? Yeah, I mean, I guess you'd hope that if someone's married to you, they would say, you know what, darling, I don't, you know, it's not like you're coming out as a Nazi or, I don't know, someone who eats tuna, which I can't stand. That's my bottom line. But, you know, there's much worse things to confess to.
When someone eats tuna, you can tell. I mean,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was actually going to say, I doubt their partner doesn't know. It's one of these things, isn't it, that they've got an inkling that that's something that's going on.
Yeah. And actually, hopefully they'd pick up the signs and they'd say, well, you know what? I love you. I don't. Unless they're married to Richard Dawkins. That would be quite funny if it was Mrs. Dawkins who was using your Fairsoul account.
I actually used to go out with a girl who's very Christian and I'm not. And I deliberately avoided all conversation about it, really, to the extent of awkwardness. But she was on the end of not believing in dinosaurs. So it was that kind of, I knew we were going to have a pretty awkward conversation. I was just avoiding that.
About the Tyrannosaurus Rex, yeah.
Just kind of avoided it.
Didn't go to the Natural History Museum for a day. That would have been awkward.
Yeah, women shouldn't wear trousers, that kind of thing.
Okay, I'll do a silly one. I go to church every Sunday like a good Christian. When the congregation says amen, I say gay men. It's childish and I might go to hell for it.
No, I don't think you go to hell for it.
If like hell was this little club next to heaven in Soho.
Yeah, gay men. Yeah, I mean, amen just means, you know, let it be so, right? That's what it means. Putting in a kind of G beforehand, I don't know whether it actually makes a difference.
Okay, I'll throw in another one. I once attended church whilst coming down from an amazing acid trip. I thought I maybe experienced God in real, in person, but all I really experienced was weird looks, boredom and increasing fatigue. It's sad, really.
Was that the come down or was that incidental or was that church?
Bad sermon.
Bad sermon, yeah. ChatGPT sermon.
Do another silly one. Our village is very kind and sweet, and now retired vicar has kept a framed picture of Jesus on his mantelpiece in his home for about 10 years. Nobody has the heart to tell him it's actually Ewan McGregor. I hope you want to know.
That is absolutely sensational. Yeah, that's very good. I mean, the whole thing is we don't really know what Jesus looked like. There's always that thing, you know.
Oh, yeah.
What did he actually look like? And they will always do like a facial reconstruction every few years. It'll be in the news. This is what Jesus really looked like, kind of Da Vinci
Code.
But
facial reconstruction based on what?
Well, yeah, right, exactly. They're like, oh, this is from people who were in that area at the time. Well, okay, fine.
Everyone's faces in this area, they're all the same, aren't
they? All famously the same, yes. So, yeah, I think let him get on with it. Maybe he doesn't like Ewan McGregor. Not in Trainspotting, though.
Maybe he actually just really likes Ewan McGregor. He doesn't even think it's Jesus. It's just like, yeah, great film.
He might be Ewan McGregor's uncle.
Phantom Menace was a good film.
It could just rock all church, couldn't it? If, like, it turned out Jesus was, like, somehow a little bit unappealing to look at.
Yeah, well.
Slightly off-putting.
Wouldn't sit next to him on the tube.
I've got a slightly church-related, not quite a confession, but my step family is quite religious. I took my son when he was 3 to see them, my step-niece, performing in a choir thing. And we're not very religious at all. And we were sat there in the church. It was a big, like, big old Catholic church with all the kind of stuff. And he looked at me and went, who is the man on the sword? And I was like, oh, yeah, God, you don't know. You don't know.
Yeah, you don't know who that is.
Yeah, I've done a bad job. I'm not raising religiously, but also you kind of should know that bit.
Basic cultural knowledge.
Basic cultural knowledge.
It's an understandable reaction. Like, what on earth is this?
Yeah, I actually like the idea of it being a big sword. It was super cool. Like Conan. It's like, it's Conan. It's Conan, Theo. Shall I do one?
Okay, Dave.
My dad was a vicar, and his most beloved possession is a vial of water from some well that's in the Bible. As a kid, I didn't want my cat to go to hell, so I used the vial of water to baptise him and then replace it with tap water. Dad cherishes that vial of tap water to this day.
I wonder where the cat is.
It's like Pet Cemetery now, stalking the living.
Yeah, an undead cat out there.
It's like topping up your dad's whiskey bottle with water, isn't it? Gradually, less and less holy.
I'll do one which was, I'm a priest. Sometimes I transform hymn lyrics into songs glorifying my cat. Once, as I was distributing communion, my younger son caught me singing one out at the altar rail.
100% relate to that. You will be, you know how when you've got a song in your head, you will sing it in the shower, you'll sing it just doing, you know, whatever. And often you will put lyrics to it, right? You'll put your own lyrics. You'll sing a stupid version of it. You'll make it about your cat or about Man United or about bums or something. I don't know. You'll make it stupid, right? The problem is if most of the music that you hear or the music that you are professionally involved with, right, is hymns, of course that happens all the time.
Ali Cataluya.
Oh, there's that great thing about Catholic was actually cataholic. I'm a cataholic. I'm addicted to cats.
Right, I've got some questions from the Fesshole community, the Fesshole care in the community. I put a message up asking what they would like to ask. And the first one was from Ed MB. And he says, if God really loves us, why did he let Elon Musk take over Twitter?
Maybe. I always say, okay, the idea is in Christianity that in the world to come, when God makes things as they are, we'll be made into our perfect forms, we'll be made into the way we're meant to be, right? But things that can't have a perfect form will just disappear. There won't be a version of them. So there won't be perfected evil because you can't have that, right? There won't be perfected disease because disease is an absence of health, right? Maybe Uncle Elon taking over Twitter is all just God putting his plan because there will be no perfect Twitter in the world to come. It can't exist as a perfected version of itself, maybe.
Wow. That's a good answer. It's disease.
Admittedly, there's a question there about cruelty because it seems to be, I'm not sure whether porn bots are kind of in God's means by which he normally acts, but takes all sorts.
Pussy in Bible.
Pussy in Bible.
Okay, do you want to do the next question, Dave, from the Fesshole community?
Sure, this is from Mazza, and it's... This is from Mazza, and Mazza's question is, do you get many... I am 100% straight, but love the D, confessions.
The denomination of Christ our Lord.
D, yeah, D standing for?
Diocese.
Diocese, I love, yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't think anyone would confess to loving their diocese. Actually, I quite like mine, they're quite nice. Yeah, well, firstly, obviously I can't reveal specifics of confessions, but what I would say, which I think most people say, most confessions are really boring. They're really boring.
Yeah.
No, I have never had anyone confess that to me, I'm afraid. Maybe I'm not seeking the right,
you know.
Yeah, you haven't put a form on the internet saying, put your worst stuff here and I'll publish the funny bits, basically.
That's where I'm going wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel that's the kind of confession that you make when you're like eliciting a, me too kind of response anyway. So, you know what I mean?
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so the next one from the questions was from Anonymous Alcoholic, which is sounds like a confession in itself. Could you ask if all the confessions you've heard boil down to one of the seven deadly sins, or are there more than seven?
Oh, that is a good question. Yeah, I think they do. I think the reason why they're there is they catch all, right? And we used to do, when I was training for the priesthood, we used to have this exercise where you had to identify, said everybody has what we call a besetting sin. They have one of those seven deadly sins that is their favourite. It just gets them in a way that others don't. It's quite a good game. Imagine seven of your friends. Who is which one?
Oh, okay.
Who's lust? Who's gluttony? Who's avarice? And it's funny, people do slot into it. You do begin to think about people, because most things do slot into one of those.
This is the Church of England sorting hat kind of BuzzFeed
quiz. Yeah. There's an element of that. Which sin are you? Tonight, Matthew, I'm going to be gluttony.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that probably is my besetting sin. A sloth, I can be lazy. That's up there.
Yeah, yeah. Like, we've all got like percentages through the days.
Yeah, it's like horoscopes, right? You're waxing Libra or whatever. There's an element where you're a little bit of this and a little bit of that. But we were then told at the end of it, he said, well, actually, all of you, the besetting sin of everyone is in fact one of the seven deadly sins. Can you think which one it might be? The one that undergirds all the rest.
I'm going to say it's pride.
Correct. It is pride.
Oh, Dave.
Yeah, well done. See? It's pride, because you only commit a sin because you think you can get away with it.
Yeah.
That's the idea. So therefore, pride is the sin that makes all the other ones possible. That's the thinking. I'm not sure I agree with that. I think you can do things that are probably sinful and not mean. Do you know what I mean? I don't think it's quite as simple as that, but there's something true about that, right? And then you want to confess it because it's like, oh, I haven't got away with it because I've told someone.
That's why I'm so humble.
Yeah, there we go.
And you've sort of like passed the X Factor quiz and you can now be, you know.
I can do whatever I like now. Got it right. Like no consequences.
Tomato Soup says, I'd prefer to hear about the actual best confessions made to a priest. He must hear some great shit. But you were saying you don't want to deliver that stuff to us.
Not to spoil anything from your book, but I think you said about a parishioner committing a dirty protest or something. Was that not a confession?
No, that was just an act. That was just, there was no, I've done this and I'm ashamed of it. It was a, I'm going to do this and I want people to tread in it, which is what happened.
Could you give a little more detail on that? I'm not sure I want to ask that now, but...
Yeah, we had a very difficult lady who we used to help where we could, but she had trashed our bathroom. We had a disabled loo that had a shower in, and so we'd let her use that. But she would trash it every time she went in, and we kept on asking her, saying, can you not trash it? Kept on doing it. And my boss, who was not Jesus, but my kind of the vicar of the church when I was just training, he was like, there's only one way to do this. We're going to lock the door. We're going to lock the door to the disabled. And if people need it, I've got the key. But unless we do this, she's going to keep on making it unusable for other people. So this happens. And he then leaves the key in the office, which, and this is crucial, we had just had recarpeted. And the church administrator, Jean, was very pleased with this new carpet. She'd been nagging for years to get this new cream carpet. So Jean had the key and my boss went off to do something else. And I was leading a service. And we had this guy who used to set up stuff for us. He was a really lovely guy, Roger. He was very camp. And Roger was doing his job of putting out the chairs and the orders of service. And suddenly we heard this, and he comes into the office and he goes, there's a shit in the church. And it then transpired that Roger had not only seen the shit, he'd then trodden in it and taken it all the way from the church to the office. It was being rubbed into the carpet. He was then running around going, there's a shit in the church, and there's shit in the church, taking this kind of feces round with him. Gene was like, get out, get out. I was behind. Chaos. It was like, as all these people arrived for the service, which was like for the mayor of Liverpool, and there was this kind of procession of this going, there's a shit in the church, wiping turd all around, followed by an absolutely furious Gene. So he's in my carpet. There was Sue, who was our cleaner, like spraying all of the bits behind it. Then I would just put a tissue on top of the little can of crap.
Like rolling out the red carpet.
Yeah, and I was like, welcome, Your Excellency, or whatever you meant to call him there. lovely to see you.
I do like the idea of the equivalent, because it's like the traditional sitcom thing is like, oh, the vicar's turned up, but you are the vicar. So you're like, oh, it's the mayor.
Oh, the mayor, yeah.
Up the stakes.
Yeah. Up the stakes, yeah.
Oh, President George W. Bush has turned up. Oh, God.
I actually think the then mayor of Liverpool is now in prison. Swings and roundabouts.
I missed that story. That's another digression we could go into. But
yeah, we could, yeah.
Okay, is there an instance, this is a question from the community, is there an instance where a priest is obligated to breach the confidentiality of the confessional?
Very interesting, and being debated at the moment around issues of safeguarding and vulnerable people. Now, the line on this is actually legally no, but what you can do is you can withhold absolution. So let's say someone were to come and confess a murder to you. You could say, I will absolve you, but only if you come and confess this to the police with me. If they say no, then there is an argument that says, well, this person has not come to confession actually wanting to confess properly. Because if you don't accept the absolution, which in this case is owning up to it, then you haven't properly confessed it, right? Because you haven't, the whole thing is you're entering into a contract where you say, bless me, Father, for I have sinned, right? And I can only do the blessing bit if you are serious about wanting to be forgiven. If you're not serious about wanting to be forgiven, my side of the bargain doesn't exist either, right? Do you see what I mean? So there is an argument there that says...
You've got some legal wriggle room, I'm saying, you're making for yourself. Yeah, yeah.
There is, of course, but there's been a couple of legal cases on this in English law. Goes back a very, very long way. The canons of 1604, right? They get quoted. It doesn't happen very often. There was a murder case in the 1860s, which was a big cause célèbre where a priest refused to reveal some information or revealed it later on when it had become public. And they said, well, why didn't you reveal that earlier? And there was kind of a question there. But yeah, I think that kind of that system whereby if someone comes to confession, for them to be taking it seriously, they have to accept what you say they need to do as penance, right? You say, okay, to be forgiven, you've got to do this. Now, for most people, that's, you know, say the Lord's Prayer, do 10 Hail Marys, whatever. Actually, if it's come with me to the police station where we're going to make this public and they say no, then you're no longer bound by the seal.
It's genuinely interesting. And it's also froze up for me personally. It's like, it's the bit missing in my whole enterprise. It's like, we have no absolution in this process. Not that I'm in any way qualified to say that.
You'd be quite busy by the sounds of things.
Yeah, yeah. The closest thing to it is just that things go live and there's a community response and people in the replies sort of like go, that's not on, or fair enough, I do the same, yeah.
Yeah, the number of favs.
Yeah, favs and retweets, yeah. This is okay, this is...
Darren Shaw says, having read Fesshole, is this actually hell?
What? Life or Fesshole or...
I think it was the
Twitter.
The experience of reading confessions on Twitter.
Was it Jean-Paul Sartre says, hell is other people? So to a certain, it's an element of truth there.
One of the great saints, Jean-Paul Sartre.
Yeah, famous.
Yeah.
And to give you a biggie, Dan Davis wanted to use this opportunity to say, the impossible one, what is the most convincing piece of evidence you can give for the existence of God? Thanks, Dan Davis.
Well, I would say... the most convincing bit of evidence I can give for God is almost irrelevant, because I don't think evidence for God works in the same way as evidence for this chair in front of me being here, or evidence that were I to drink that bottle of Bacardi, I would be sick. It doesn't work in quite the same way. But I would ask, if someone believes in beauty and love and truth, believes in those things that we think give our lives meaning, I would ask, where do you think those come from? And I would say, do you think they just exist out of nowhere? They're abstracts. Fair enough. Do you think they come from people? In which case, how do you then reconcile, well, history, hell being other people, our actual experience of people, right? On the whole, people don't really always, I suppose this is at the heart of what you're doing. You have their evidence that people don't always behave in ways that are loving or beautiful or true, right? That is not, I would suggest, actually in human nature. But we do have this kind of desire to yearn towards those things. So if those things are absolutes, if they do exist, if beauty exists, if truth exists, if love exists, to my mind, they have to have an existence that is rooted somewhere outside of the human. They have to be of the divine. That is my conjecture. Some people won't believe that, but that's my conjecture. And I think evidence, i.e. how humans and how the world works, would point towards that being more true than saying, actually, I think they're rooted in me because I'm lovely and beautiful and true. So whilst I acknowledge that isn't evidence in the way that doing a chemical experiment is evidence, to my mind, that is what I point to and what I believe gives me a sense of there being something more than me.
That's a very good answer. I'm like, no, I disagree. Actually, I think you're fine.
Dave believes in the Norse gods.
Oh, they're fun. Bit more shagging and murdering than old Jesus.
Just big old people.
Yeah. Well, there's a big gap in Jesus's memoirs, isn't there? I don't know what he did for like 30 odd years. So.
Teenage years.
I think someone did write that once and it was pretty bad.
Yeah. And there's, I don't know, there's some other bits of stuff people have in the Quran or something.
Oh, yeah. There's bits about Jesus there.
Young Jesus or something. Yeah.
Like young Sheldon, you've made it sound like.
That young Sheldon. Can't be as bad as that.
Thank you very much, Fergus Butler-Galley, for coming in. It's really an absolute delight.
Thank you.
And our producer tells us we need to encourage listeners to subscribe, rate and review wherever they get their podcasts. Dave, can you tell them this?
Our producer tells us we need to encourage listeners to subscribe, rate and review wherever they get their podcasts.
Fergus, do you want to tell people that?
What is it? Subscribe, rate and review wherever you get your podcast. Is that right?
Yeah, that'll do. That'll do. That'll do. Yeah.
Close enough.
Smash those like buttons, whatever it is. That's YouTube, isn't it?
Buy Fergus's book.
Yeah, yeah. Touching cloth.
It's very good of you. Well, thank you for having me. It's been great.
To finish on a nice note, Fesshole isn't horror. It can be stuff we've published just to wind up other podcasters. And this came through today. One of my friends is a proper Rory Stewart fan to the point where they have his face on T-shirts, and I've lost respect for them accordingly. On that bombshell, we're killing it all.